Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. Today we're going to resume with The Feminization of American Culture by Anne Douglas from back in 1977, a serious intellectual feminist studying serious intellectual people and the changes, the de-riggering of American religion and intellectual life, at least commercially, the takeover of mass culture, the rise of sentimentalism and essentially women's opinion and being deferred to across a wider area of subjects, as we conclude Chapter 7 and Part 2 of The Feminization of American Culture. Won't be too long. Let's dig in. Feminine, and I should say first, you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and later permanently archived at alexlinder.com. Feminine sentimentalism is the subsection we begin with. Feminine sentimentalism, the bitterness of Harriet Beecher Stowe. You remember her from such classics as Uncle Tom's Cabin. And we're going to do page 293 through 310. Unmistakably, this was a game that two could play as well as one. The women I have been considering were hardly unaware of the hostility emanating from their clerical and literary brethren, and they returned it with interest. Examples are plentiful, but none is more compelling than the one offered by Harriet Beecher Stowe. Among the most gifted women of her generation, Stowe fiercely defended her adored brother Henry Ward in his hour of need, but there can be no doubt that in a larger sense his cause was not altogether hers. During the years of the Henry affair, Stowe published two important novels, My Wife and I, 1871, and We and Our Neighbors, 1874, to which I have referred in earlier chapters. Both originally appeared in the Christian Union, a weekly of which Henry Ward was editor, and they are very distinctly magazine writing, as none of Stowe's earlier serialized novels were. Neither of them is up to the level of her previous works, Uncle Tom's Cabin, The Minister's Wooing, The Pearl of Oars Island, and Old Town Folks. In their pages, Stowe is solving, or coming close to solving, her own problems as a woman, a writer, and a religious believer, but her solutions are not commendable. If Henry Ward had unconsciously presented the tableau of women at men's mercy, Harriet triumphantly displayed the scene of man abject under feminine rule. She managed to analyze and mock the futilities inherent in the position of the liberal minister and the male sentimentalist. She recorded an enormous scorn for masculinity itself. Harriet had more to lose than Henry did. Both brother and sister were, in a real sense, geniuses. While Henry's true calling, however, was commercial, Harriet's was ethical. To take her revenge on an unjust society, she abandoned a romantic, essentially historical style for a sentimental approach to which historical concerns were painfully peripheral. Harriet Beecher, like all the Beecher children who made their mark, started her career riding on her father's coattails. Lyman Beecher was always enthusiastic about Hattie's gifts. Before she was 10, he pronounced her a genius and only wished she was a boy. Stowe repaid her father's admiration by memorizing dozens of hymns as a small child and composing bona fide sermons at various points over her long life. We have seen how Stowe clung to her mother's memory, but it was, after all, a memory. She was 5 when her mother died. She was very much her father's daughter, if not his superior, and in ways for which one admires and likes her. Of Beecher's children, only she relished the vernacular as he did. She outdid her father in her shrewd instinct for comedy, and became the only major feminine humorist 19th-century America produced. She had Beecher's ear for dialect, his eye for realistic detail. With this relish for the actual Stowe combined, like her father, a genuine sense of the sublime. She combined a genuine sense of the sublime. Lyman and Harriet grasped the essential Calvinist truth, which Melville understood so well, that sin itself is the sublime, and that only its enormity puts men on speaking terms with God. So when you sin, you're in some sense on the level with God because you chose an outcome even against what your own creator wanted, making you godlike. In adolescence, Stowe emoted properly and passionately over that archetype of the sublime, Niagara, the falls. In adulthood, on her first tour of Europe, she promptly rejected the effeminate beauties of Raphael for the excesses of the all-powerful Rubens. In a spirit her father could have understood, she exulted that Rubens's triumphant, abounding life had dragged her, quote, at his chariot wheels, and proceeded to articulate her rather peculiar aesthetic demands. Art has satisfied me at last. I have been conquered, and that is enough. Stowe thought that the very pain Rubens caused her proved him a real, living artist. She takes for granted here that great art is a form of onslaught. That was indeed the art of Calvinism, of Lyman Beecher, and of Uncle Tom's Cabin, art as onslaught. Stowe wrote her masterful anti-slavery novel in part to show up the faint-hearted American clergy, of which Lyman Beecher was in this case a conspicuous example, and she picked a form they were sure to recognize. Uncle Tom's Cabin is a great book, not because it is a great novel, but because it is a great revival sermon, aimed directly at the conversion of its hearers. In subsequent years, in a series of sometimes rambling, sometimes sentimental, but always witty and alert narratives, Stowe conducted the most brilliant exploration of New England Calvinism as a theology and lifestyle ever conceived by an American. Let's go over that sentence again. In subsequent years, after Uncle Tom's Cabin, in a series of sometimes rambling, sometimes sentimental, but always witty and alert narratives, Stowe conducted the most brilliant exploration of New England Calvinism as a theology and a lifestyle ever conceived by an American. No one understood better Calvinism's repressive aspects, especially in relation to women. No one saw more clearly the inevitability of its decline. But Calvinism was, nonetheless, the subject of Stowe's best work. The little girl whose father had complimented her by wishing she were a boy grew up to be a woman and an artist whose achievement was to beat Daddy at his own game, and, more important, to realize far more fully than he the meaning of the religious vocabulary they both employed. Her tragedy was that, when she rejected this vocabulary, as in the quest for self-expression incumbent on a temperament as creative as hers, she inevitably did, she found nothing fully adequate with which to replace it. Her failure is a revealing one. In 1869, the Countess Guiccioli, once Lord Byron's mistress, published her Recollections of Lord Byron. She whitewashed the English poet and damned his wife as censorious, cold, and vindictive. The Byrons had parted at Lady Byron's insistence a half century earlier. Both of them were now dead, but interest in the old scandal still ran high and largely in Lord Byron's favor. Stowe, who had become Lady Byron's confidant in several revelatory sessions in England in the 1850s, rose at once to her friend's defense in Lady Byron Vindicated. She knew, from Lady Byron, she claimed, what later biographers have confirmed, that Byron never loved his wife and married to cover his love affair with his half-sister Augusta. As Stowe saw it, Lady Byron had had no choice but to leave him, and her subsequent silence had been an act of compassionate nobility. In trying to destroy Lord Byron through her hysterical panegyric on his wife, Stowe was undermining a poet who had fascinated her father. Byron had, moreover, long held immense personal significance for her. In her basically sympathetic portrayal of the very Byronic Aaron Burr in The Minister's Wooing, 1859, Stowe had pictured him as an apostate from the Calvinist tradition of his famous ancestry, yet one still paradoxically enmeshed in essentially Calvinist thought patterns. Her Burr is finally Calvinist precisely because he knows he is damned, and this awareness is the source of Stowe's concern. His self-disdain, as well as his good breeding, advertise him as a gentleman, if not a Christian. The story closes, at some cost to the narrative, to which he has been largely peripheral, with an account of the erection of a simple monument on Burr's neglected grave. Stowe cannot shut him out altogether from the circle of redemption. Her reading of the same character in Old Town Folks, 1869, Ellery Davenport, is much harsher. This Byron Burr figure is less a sinner than a cheater and a deceiver. He almost destroys the happiness of the gay and childlike heroine, Tina. At the end of this line of development, the Byron of Lady Byron Vindicated is a tormented voluptuary who commits incest because he longed for the stimulation of a new kind of vice. He is still a believer. "The worst of it is, I do believe," he reportedly told Lady Byron, but he no longer engrosses Stowe's interest or compassion. Stowe is identifying less with a Byronic hero than with a woman he inevitably wrongs. She has developed a sharper and more self-conscious sense of sisterhood. Yet the price Stowe pays for it is fearful and reveals a great deal about the sexual polarities of her culture. To defame Byron was not only to censure a traducer of her sex, but also to defame rebelliousness and its products. The remorse which Stowe rightly perceived as the inspiration for Byron's obsessive creativity. His pain was at least kin to that she herself had once felt before Rubens and defined as essential to Calvinism and art. Byron was regarded by Lyman Beecher and by Stowe as the poet of the sublime. To praise Lady Byron, no matter how unfairly she was maligned, was to laud a denial of creativity and to extol conformity. A reserved and dignified philanthropist, Lady Byron was an exemplar of Anglican benevolence, not of Puritan guilt. The writing of Lady Byron Vindicated was an important event for Stowe. The book antagonized thousands of readers, but more important, it advertised Stowe's newfelt freedom in the early and mid-1870s. She was adopting the self-worship inculcated by sentimental feminine antinomianism, which her extraordinary intelligence had prevented her from fully assuming all her insecure and chaotic life. She was beginning to boast rather than to analyze. So, sentimentalism turns into narcissism. Narcissistic rage is at the heart of Harriet Beecher Stowe's writings of the late 1860s and early 1870s. She wrote, "My wife and I, and we and our neighbors, in part to regain the public she had alienated with Lady Byron Vindicated." Yet these two novels pulse with essentially the same hostility, no less intense for its new coyness. In neither of these works has Stowe given up her long-standing attempt to supplant her father and obtain his ministerial authority. She has, rather, displaced him entirely by tacitly redefining the true sacerdotal office to exclude him. Sacerdotal means of the priest. Stowe's earlier heroines had all been ministerial stand-ins. Mary Scudder in The Minister's Wooing, for example, makes many more converts than Dr. Hopkins, but they had been recognizable ones. Like Mara, her successor in The Pearl of Oars Island, Mary palpably wants, in her fashion, just like Lyman Beecher in his, to save souls. And her whole life is a clear preparation for her mission. She is a church member, an assiduous and thoughtful reader of the Bible. Stowe's frivolous later heroines no longer need any resemblance to the usual ministerial pattern to claim its sanctity. They are completely unschooled and totally secularized. They are ministers who are anti-ministers, prophets of the culture-bound family faith which was to dominate America's religious future. The culture-bound family faith. Harriet Beecher Stowe's new credo could be summed up thus. Salvation comes through the agency of the average woman. And her heroines are, quote, average with a vengeance. For how else can Stowe demonstrate that any woman is better than any man? Her creative impulse has narrowed perilously near a scorn of any real accomplishment as, by definition, masculine, and rejection of the effort, privatization, and suffering she knew were attendant on it. Stowe's disintegration as a writer is evident in the New York novels, and her curious relish at the thinness, the mediocrity of these stories is equally apparent. Not long after publishing My Wife and I, Stowe, with astonishing condescension, could remark to her great contemporary, George Eliot, who was a female, that Middlemarch, fine as it was, lacked jollitude. With a note of breezy reproach, Stowe informs the English author that she writes on, quote, so high a plane, it is all self-abnegation. Stowe's failure of insight seems almost deliberate. She could not be making it clearer that her own days of self-abnegation and a great achievement are triumphantly over. By a similar and equally painful logic, in the New York novels, Stowe, for the first time in her career, totally abandoned historical and recognizable models for her characters. The Key to Uncle Tom's Cabin, a collection of historical documents that purported to substantiate the story of Uncle Tom, proved Stowe's not entirely conscious veracity in her first masterpiece. Nat Turner, Samuel Hopkins, Byron, Savonarola inspired several of her finest later portraits. Her feminine characters, for obvious reasons, had seldom derived from prominent historical sources, but until 1871 they had always played, and often forcibly, against masculine characters drawn from real life. In My Wife and I, all characters are fictional. Moreover, We and Our Neighbors is the first actual sequel Stowe ever wrote. Like the male sentimentalists, including her brother, she was newly fascinated with the possibilities of art lovingly imitating art, with the excision not only of competition, of standards, but of experience itself. Calvinism itself is predictably the first male achievement which Stowe is intent on demolishing. It is important to remember that these novels and sketches are Episcopalian and, equally important to add, Episcopalian as Stowe understood the term. She, with many other intelligent Americans, had turned to the Anglican Church in the mid-1860s. It had much to offer her. One should not overlook the fact that Stowe's move to Episcopalianism in part bore witness to her broadening religious and social vision. She genuinely welcomed the potential Catholicism of the Anglican Church in an immigrant and urban culture. She was cognizant of the ways its organization and its orders allowed it to work more effectively in the exploding cities in which her father's denomination, Presbyterian Congregationalist, was failing to take real hold. Yet it seems undeniable that in her religious realignment, Stowe was confirming and hastening her flight from self-criticism and from the authority of vital experience. Despite some sometimes bitter internal debate over the growing use of ritual initiated by the Oxford movement, the Anglican Church was, comparatively speaking, a model of non-conflict in a very conflicted society. It was crucial to Stowe that the Episcopal set, alone among Protestant denominations, claimed a history of organic evolution from the primitive church. Certainly in American life, the Anglican Church put a premium on continuity and serenity. The Baptist, Presbyterians, and Methodists all split officially and deeply on the slavery issue prior to the Civil War, and the fissures were, in some sense, well-nigh unbridgeable. The Episcopalian Church never divided because, as one of its historians has pointed out, it simply refused to recognize the issue. The style of Anglican ecclesiastical ceremony confirmed the Church's image in Stowe's eyes as a model of tasteful self-approbation, self-approval. Of course, the Episcopal Church, despite its participation in the urban revivals of 1857 and 1858, was non-evangelical. It's not going out seeking members. The kind of total self-examination which supposedly accompanied the conversion experience in other sects was never demanded of its members. Moreover, the Episcopalian rector was wedded to his prayer book and to a fixed service which de-emphasized the sermon. His language was the conservative one of public ceremony, again the elite are part of the Episcopal Church in America. It is important that Stowe joined the church just at the time when rituals were proliferating. Despite low church protest, crosses, candles, saints' days, daily matins and vatins and vespers, choral services, weekly communion, even sacramental confession and absolution and elevation of the host were borrowed from Catholic practice by Episcopalians, generally the more emotional, the more rituals, etc., is the lower class. Self-control is more associated with higher class, so it would be less rituals, more mental, intellectual. And that's true across the board and everything. Till you get to the bottom of the barrel, the Negroes jumping and shouting and screaming, and the Pentecostals rolling around, lolling their tongues, speaking in tongues, screaming and flopping. That's not high class activity. That would be considered the lowest class activity. Stowe's New York novels show that she heartily approved of most of these practices, and with sure instinct dismissed only those which posterity has also rejected. As we will see, these rituals had significant narcissistic potential for her. The Protestant, non-Anglican ministry is not presented as a viable option in the New York novels and sketches. Henry Henderson, the narrator of My Wife and I, We and Our Neighbor, and We and Our Neighbors, is the son of a small-town New England clergyman who has much in common with Lyman Beecher. Absorbed in theological controversy, quote, naturally impetuous, though magnanimous, Reverend Henderson has love, but limited time for his offspring. When Henry is born, he takes a short break from his work. God bless him, said my father, kissing me and my mother. And then he returned to an important treatise, which was to reconcile the decrees of God with the free agency of men, and which the event of my entrance into this world had interrupted for some hours. The sermon was a perfect success. I am told, and nobody that heard it ever had a moment's further trouble on the subject. That's some gentle irony. Little Henry naturally devotes himself to his loving mother and fantasizes about a day when his father will be old and unable to preach. After Reverend Henderson's death, his closest friend explains that his greatness was not in his theology, into which he poured all his energies, but in his benevolent heart, which he in the main ignored. In other words, insofar as he was lucky enough to resemble his wife, he was successful. What he thought to be his achievement was largely a rather touching waste of time. Stowe displays even less sympathy for the more timid clerical souls whom Lyman Beecher had fought decades earlier in Boston. Reverend Henderson may have been an anachronism, but at least he was a man. My Wife and I opens with a section entitled, The Author Defines His Position, which is in part a cruelly piercing attack on the often pathetic attempts of the contemporary liberal clergy to rationalize and popularize their predicament. A few lines will give the flavor. Block quote. The Reverend Dr. Cool Shadow will go on with his interesting romance of, quote, Christianity, a dissolving view, designed to show how everything is, in many respects, like everything else, and all things lead somewhere, and everything will finally end somehow, and therefore that it is important that everybody should cultivate general sweetness and have the very best time possible in this world. So that's a satire of liberalizing Christianity. And it would get even worse because we'd see in the 20th century it would turn into overt political causes that are simply hellish. Faced with such options, it is hardly surprising that Henry Henderson never considers the ministry seriously as a possible profession. He knows he lacks the faith necessary to meet its demands and challenges, and he spends no time agonizing about his deficiency. Instead, he chooses a career in the popular press that is competing so handily with the religious one, and becomes a reporter for a New York newspaper. The male sentimentalists come off no better than the ministers in Stowe's acerbic pages. The very title of My Wife and I reminds the reader of George Curtis's Prue and I, the episodic narrative in the male narrators of all the work Stowe turned out between 1868 and 1874, with the exception of Pink and White Tyranny, suggest the same source. Little Foxes, 1866, The Chimney Corner, 1866, and House and Home Papers, 1865, the preparatory works for the New York novels, are collected sketches which originally appeared in the Atlantic Monthly. Christopher Crowfield, their narrator, is reminiscent of Prue's husband, quote, a literary man with a somewhat delicate nervous organization and a sensitive stomach. He is bald, fastidious, domesticated, and effete. Like Mitchell's Bachelor, he loves to lie, quote, back in my study chair with my heels luxuriously propped on an ottoman. This is my cloudland where I love to sail away in dreamy quietude, forgetting the war, the price of coal and flour, until his strong-minded practical wife briskly reminds him of approaching deadlines. Crowfield embarrasses the reader with the apologetic excesses of his self-dislike. Palpably afraid of the women he propitiates by imitation, he deprecates himself as a clumsy old blind Vulcan. Since he is Stowe's puppet, he is in part expressing her own sentiments about him, but Stowe is also getting at the lack of self-respect which was so crippling in writers like Curtis and Mitchell. Henry Henderson, though neither a minister nor an author, seems weak in every sense. When as a child he first leaves home to go to day school, he is in terror of the big boys who threaten to bully him. Then Daisy, the first love of his life, whom, with precocious anticipation of the domestic state, he calls his child wife, comes to his rescue. She has his place moved to the girl's side of the room. I was a blessed little boy from that moment, he tells us. He is completely dependent on little Daisy, as he will be on Eva Van Arsdell, his legal wife. And no wonder. Males in these books are either awkward brutes, stumbling amid feminine subtleties, or wistful would-be transvestites. In either form, they are by nature failures, just as the women are by nature successes. It is quite clear that Henry Henderson has no other function than to provide an audience, a mirror, an adorer for his wife or wives. The crucial point is that his subjugation, unlike that of Prue's husband, is not apparent, but real. Henry, presumably spending a good deal of time writing about Eva and all her little doings, is advertising his sexual disadvantage. And Eva's doings are very little indeed. Stowe was much too intelligent not to have doubts about her new fashionable heroine, whom I have already described as the proto-consumer. Pink and White Tyranny, which appeared in the same year as My Wife and I, reveals the superficiality, the coldness, the utter small-mindedness of Lily Ellis, a society belle who, to the casual eye, might seem very similar to Eva Van Arsdell. But if Lily represents Stowe's fears about the modish modern girl, Eva suggests her hopes, and in My Wife and I and We and Our Neighbors, she indulges them to the uttermost. Before her marriage, Eva is a pretty society flirt, with somewhat higher aspirations than the wealthy loveless match which clearly seems in the offing. She is a regular churchgoer, but her theology, as we have seen, is a trivial and subjective know-nothingism. She prefers the biblical explanation of the creation to the Darwinian one because, as she says, quote, I think it a good deal easier to believe the Garden of Eden story, especially as that's pretty and poetical, and is in the dear old book that is so sweet and comfortable to us. A quote like this suggests accurately not only the thinness of her personality, but the impoverishment of her language. She talks as James was to make Daisy Miller talk just a few years later. Henry James. Stowe, who could exult over the curly-whirlies of Eva's lovely younger sister Angelique, was clearly past the point of being critical of her slight heroine. Eva's great charm for everyone, including her author and her husband, apparently lies in her tasteful wardrobe. Admiring her, Henry feels compensated for, quote, those severe edicts which decree that male dress should be dull, like some kind of bird. The female of the species is apparently destined to brilliant plumage, the male to drab. Henry's wits seem as dull as his clothes when he gapes over her finery, yet it is clear he is undergoing a religious experience, and more particularly an Episcopalian one. Eva's clothes and the process by which she adorns herself are at some level for Stowe analogous to the rituals of her newfound church. In the two novels in which Eva figures, Stowe lingers fondly over scenes in which young couples adorn and readorn little chapels at appropriate seasons. Not too surprisingly, the young men always fall adoringly in love with the young ladies on such occasions. In We and Our Neighbors, St. John, a devout Episcopalian rector, has redecorated his church in blue and gold. He is stunned when Angelique Van Arsdell conducts her Sunday school class in a matching blue and gold outfit. Of course, although hitherto absorbed in his church, he now falls in love with her. In Stowe's narcissistic imagination, the woman has herself become the church, and the man is a rapturous communicant. Eva is quite frank about her ambitions. In We and Our Neighbors, counseling her sister to abandon her vague, girlish dreams of a hero husband, she explains sagely, "Your heroes like to sit on pedestals and have you worship them. Now, for my part, I'd rather have a good, kind man that will worship me." See, here it goes. One of the most famous authors of the 19th century, Harriet Beecher Stowe. The woman is an object of worship. The man is a little nothing who's only fit to worship her. Her emphasis on the man here, however, is somewhat misleading. She is all for marriage, eager to make matches for her sisters and friends at every turn. But her motive is not finally respect for the value of the male. Her aim in life is the essentially narcissistic one, of multiplying her image by creating little domesticated replicas of her life. She holds her Thursday evening get-togethers to implicate her friends at once in the domestic process. They are to participate, admire, and do likewise, and six of them do. Eva's own marriage is absolutely without content or meaning, except as a model. It is an advertisement, not a product. After the honeymoon, her husband's adoration is assumed but not expressed. At one point, we see them going to bed together in a classically sexless scene. He, exhausted from the day, is half asleep, while she is chatting on about subjects which don't interest him. The vignette closes with her superior acceptance of his indifference and her amusement at his rather gross physical fatigue. Oh, you sleepyhead. Well, never mind. Good night. There is no evidence in either novel that the female of the species ever needs sleep. She is on a perpetual, sprightly alert. Needless to say, the couple has no children. It is apparent that Eva has no time for childbearing. She is too busy showing off. It is as irrelevant to expect children from her as to expect a doll to talk. Henry is generally absent from home. He is like a character always off stage, for Stowe increasingly omits any information about his job. When at home, he is a factotum figure. That's a general purpose gopher. Step and fetch it. Butler to her. Someone who does whatever you need done. Furthermore, we almost never find this model couple alone in the home they love so much. Either guests arrive, or one of them goes out, Eva to visit, Henry to work, or to his club. The reader is thoroughly sympathetic with their apparently inconsistent dread of privacy. It is all too evident that, once alone without an audience, they would cease to exist. A little bit of an echo of class there in Thomas Fussell. How the middle class all do the same things and keep their doors open in their little subdivision. One must say, to do her credit, that Eva, in chatting with her potential mimics, is never base enough to insinuate that romance or even love has much to do with marriage. There is a businesslike air lurking behind these matchmaking tete-a-tetes. She is always enticing her feminine friends by the possibility that they can make some man by taking him up as a matrimonial investment. The arguments she uses on her sister Alice in favor of her suitor Jim, a cheery young reporter, are typical. Your influence might help him in his career, she points out. Alice agrees. Jim ought to be married, certainly, she says in a reflective tone. Just the right kind of marriage would be the making of him. But Ava's clinching argument is an interesting version of the let's keep it in the family approach. Quote, I do think it would be a nice thing for all of us if you could like Jim, for he's one of us. We all know him and like him. You might settle down right here and live near us and all go on together cozily. Jim's main selling point is apparently that he is already familiar, already domesticated. He sounds a bit like a prefab house, ready to be put up. In marrying Jim, Alice can quickly dispose of him and get to the real business of female life, setting up an easy, nice, cozy home for others to envy and imitate. Needless to say, she accepts him. Eva exults over their prospective marriage and two others she has skillfully engineered in a letter written to her mother-in-law. These letters, which punctuate the narratives at regular intervals, are in themselves rather curious affairs. They seldom tell us anything we have not already learned through the direct narrative. Their purpose is not to inform, but rather by the narcissistic process on which the book operates, structurally as well as thematically, to reflect, to gloat. As Eva redescribes the trivia which comprise her life, she repossesses her kingdom, and it replicates it once again for her somewhat weary readers. Here, at her peak as a matrimonial entrepreneur, in the key sentence of the book, she unabashedly demands her due pound of praise. Quote, Mother, doesn't it seem as if our bright, cozy, happy, free and easy home was throwing out as many side shoots as a lilac bush? The natural, even floral, connotations of Eva's metaphor seem insidiously deceptive. One has a vision of an unending assembly line, mass-producing thousands of these homes, essentially empty, like Eva's and Henry's, each existing only because the others do. Incest has been commercialized. And end of that subset. So you see Harriet Beecher Stowe bringing about this narcissistic woman interested mainly in things being nice. And this is by the 1870s, all this is going on. Next subset, the last one in this section and part, or chapter and part, is the loss of romanticism. The loss of romanticism. Stowe's late novels hint painfully at the tragic dead end of Victorian American culture. There is the viciousness between the sexes. There is the triumphant drift toward a consumer and mass media society. Eva, the shopper. Henry, the newspaper reporter. Stowe herself, at least momentarily, the advocate of the superficial, the replicable. Equally important in these books, however, is what has been lost. Theology, feminism, and romanticism, to all of which Stowe, like others in her culture, was logically the heir. So I think you see here the author, Anne Douglas, sees feminism as what she's doing, serious intellectual work, and how rare that is today. Most of the intellectual work is purely ideological, superficial, extremely anti-men and anti-white. But Douglas, while she had a different view than the people she's writing about, understood it was serious, rigorous stuff, and saw herself in that line and treated a serious thing seriously. And that's what makes you a serious man. And that's what makes Anne Douglas a serious woman. So that someone like me would treat her with respect because she has more than earned it with her careful, serious work. That's how it is. And you... Opinions are not equal. There's no equality. There's no cheapness, you see. So someone's either serious or they're a clown. That's how I look at it. And we mostly live in a clown world nowadays, but this woman was a serious. That's why we're taking the time. And we're getting a deeper understanding of the theology and the men and women of the time, the different writers, and how they all came together. So... It's a sad thing, essentially, that what we're seeing here. Triumphant drift. There is the triumphant drift toward a consumer and mass media society. Stowe herself, at least momentarily, the advocate of the superficial, the replicable. Equally important in these books, however, is what has been lost. Theology. Feminism. See, real feminism, serious intellectual work done by women, and romanticism, to all of which Stowe, like others in her culture, was logically the heir. So it belonged to their fathers, and they threw it away. Stowe herself is not to blame for this profoundly disappointing end to a brilliant career. She did what she did in a half-understood effort to vindicate women in the most effective way in a society that she sensed undervalued them. But it was a costly vindication, for to accomplish it, she had to debase all that was best in her own religious heritage, repress all that was strongest in her own creativity, and then boast of it all. A period which produced Nathaniel Hawthorne, Herman Melville, Walt Whitman, Henry David Thoreau, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Edward A. Park, and Horace Bushnell, among others, produced no women, with the exceptions of Margaret Fuller and Stowe, who could match their claims, even if the standards used were appropriately rephrased and redefined. Edward Beecher, the most impressive of Lyman's sons, was, if anything, less gifted and less intelligent than either of his more famous sisters. His achievements cannot match Harriet's, and are no greater than Catherine's. He was every bit as eccentric as they were. He still had a balance, a restraint, a dignity, even a decency, which they lacked. I could make Edward Beecher sound ridiculous by paraphrasing his wildest notions about reincarnation, but I would only need to quote a few lines from the most excessive statements in his monumental Conflict of Ages to make my reader know that she would not laugh to his face, that Edward Beecher must be taken seriously. To quote Catherine Esther Beecher, however, ludicrously grim with moral rage and the truth stranger than fiction, or to read from Little Eva's death scene in Uncle Tom's Cabin, is, first of all, at some level, to amuse. Only later can one ask for reflection and analysis. Edward Beecher was perhaps misguided, but his sisters were inflated, overdone, and the difference is vital. He was not always balanced, but they occasionally lacked all sense of proportion. This has nothing to do with propriety. Once, when Horace Bushnell was in London, he felt neglected and unknown, but he consoled himself with the thought that, quote, anything which sets a man practically in his place is a mental good, a good of manners, of feeling, dignity itself, close quote. It was precisely this precondition to intellectual honesty, a sense of proper place, the true and indispensable room of one's own, that the middle-class northern woman, no matter how intelligent, lacked. They didn't see themselves in the correct perspective, she's saying. It ended in their becoming narcissistic and taking on airs. Whereas the men, even her inferior brother, who was inferior to her in talent, did understand his true place. Because she didn't say that northern middle-class intellectuals lack, she said that middle-class northern women, no matter how intelligent, lack. So here's a feminist who is willing to make sexual generalizations about women and find them less or worse than men. So basically, Douglas is fair and honest, and that's why she's worthy of study and respect, along with her great intellectual achievements. And my point is, that's true for you, that's true for me, that's true for anyone. There has to be a seriousness about it. There have to be standards. And ultimately, there has to be judgment, and it can't be frivolous. It has to be grounded in something substantial. This is how we become serious, real, respectable people, respectable in the best sense. You should care what others think when the others are valuable, serious people. Don't be a clown, is what I'm saying. A lot of people think that to become a clown, all you got to do is put a red rubber ball in your nose. But there's even easier ways than that. Wear your big floppy shoes with your cheap thought. Now, let's see. Both exalted and ignored, was the lady the savior of her nation or a slave to an unappreciative master? Defined in unexplored extremes, she inevitably often dealt with them in herself, and encourage those segments of her culture most committed to the avoidance of self-examination. Encourage those segments of her culture most committed to the avoidance of self-examination. Inevitably, she was profoundly disaffected from politics. It was not simply that she was barred from the polls and her rights. It wasn't just that she couldn't vote. She had little to gain from the sense of placing, the awareness of class and interest, of societal structure, which genuine political consciousness fosters. When she obtained the vote in 1920, she used it with indifference. She voted with her men, not because she was sheep-like, as various commentators claimed, but because, paradoxically, politics were not her politics. Sentimentalism had, for too long, served her needs better. For sentimentalism might be defined as the political sense obfuscated or gone rancid. Sentimentalism, unlike the modes of genuine sensibility, never exists except in tandem with failed political consciousness. A relatively recent phenomenon whose appearance is linked with capitalist development, sentimentalism seeks and offers the distraction of sheer publicity. Sentimentalism is a cluster of ostensibly private feelings which always attains public and conspicuous expression. Privacy functions in the rituals of sentimentalism only for the sake of titillation, as a convention to be violated. Involved as it is with the exhibition and commercialization of the self, sentimentalism cannot exist without an audience. It has no content but its own exposure, and it invests exposure with a kind of final significance. Little wonder that Harriet Beecher Stowe closed her career as a show-off. And she had plenty of company. It is fitting, I think, that my chosen period, which covers the, quote, feminization or sentimentalization of Northeastern culture, ends with a series of scandals, most notably, as we have seen, Harriet Beecher Stowe's notorious expose of Lord Byron's relations with his half-sister, Augusta, and Henry Ward Beecher's much-publicized affair with Libby Tilton. Incest underlay both scandals. Brother and sister, minister and parishioner, were advertising in bed, as in print, their rather unhealthy, and not altogether willing, need of one another. Like Stowe's New York novels and the writings of the male sentimentalists, these affairs suggested what could be called the mirror phenomenon increasingly dominant in American life. Replication of the self, absorption in the self, disguises confusion as to the purpose of the self. Politics yields to publicity. Many newspapermen and cartoonists rebaptized their trade during the years of the Beecher-Byron controversy and the Beecher-Tilton trial. Some papers devoted as many as 10 reporters to the coverage of the Brooklyn imbroglio. In a self-immersed and self-congratulatory culture, unable to generate the genuine tensions and purposefulness of criticism, only scandal remains to provide the sense of ritual excitation without which mass communal life is intolerable. The triumph of sentimentalism in 19th century America is never clearer than when one realizes the relatively small number of romantic writers and theologians, male or female, this country produced. For, however one defines the romantic impulse, and I do not pretend to be doing that adequately here, it clearly involves a genuinely political and historical sense, a spirit of critical protest alien to the sentimentalism so often confused with it. So romanticism and sentimentalism are two very different things. You're essentially, in sentimentalism, you're exposing private emotions and you're attention-whoring in a slightly more dignified, older way, but still what would become recognizably the modern thing. There's no depth to it. There's no political politics to it. It's just overting yourself for that end, to gain attention. Whereas genuine romanticism, it was a big movement in Germany, Goethe, Schiller, we're going to hear, Kate Shelley in England, is something different. There's political and there's historical anchors to it, or correlations to it. They're mirrored in your feelings, and your feelings are the microcosm, your sentiments, where it might be confused with sentimentalism, and the larger historical political context. So you might see your own personal battle in the spirit of the times. Let's say, what would an example today be? Maybe a man being reamed by a divorce court, and his having this knowledge that that's his microcosmic personal tragedy or personal struggle, and at the macrocosm it would be his knowing that the laws that made this possible, that facilitated this stuff, were put in place by a race trying to destroy his own. So you see, that's what it would be like, except in the 1800s. The triumph of sentimentalism in 19th century America is never clearer than when one realizes the relatively small number of romantic writers and theologians, male or female, this country produced. For however one defines the romantic impulse, and I do not pretend to be doing that adequately here, it clearly involves a genuinely political and historical sense, a spirit of critical protest alien to the sentimentalism so often confused with it. Romantics such as Goethe, Schiller, Keats, Shelley, Coleridge, or even Byron, again the 1800-1830 period, never lost touch with ethical concerns as the mainspring of their inspiration. Byron's once celebrated death in the cause of Greek liberty may seem self-glorifying, even diversionary, to some of us now. It is still today, as it was to the Greeks then, a profoundly different matter from staying at home, writing odes to Greece, and dying in bed. The unmistakable exaltation of the self found in the works of the Romantics was a desperate attempt to find in private resources an antidote, and not an alternative, to the forces of modernizing society. It was not, like sentimentalist self-absorption, a commercialization of the inner life. The test which distinguishes Romanticism from sentimentalism is that its language, its rhetoric, no matter how strained or foreign to modern ears, has not, to use Hemingway's phrase, gone bad, direct quote, gone bad. Language, like that of the sentimentalist, which has utterly capitulated to the drift of its times, invariably goes bad. Perhaps we would not write today in the way Shelley, for example, did, lines like, "Hail to thee, blithe spirit, bird thou never wert, that far from heaven or near it pourest thy full heart, in profuse strains of unpremeditated art," may ring a bit grandiose, but we understand that the relationship of such language to its age is fundamentally healthy, is one we might wish in our very different fashion to approximate. The language of Victorian religiosity, whether it appears in the pages of Dickens or of Mrs. Sigourney, we at once reject, at least consciously, as a useful model. Mrs. Sigourney wrote about birds too. Beautiful boy with the sunny hair, what wouldst thou do with that birdling rare? It belongs to the sky, it hath wings, you know. Loosen your clasping and let him go. We find so much of this rancid writing in our 19th century literature. Mrs. Sigourney's present disrepute by no means obviates her enormous popularity among her contemporaries. And where is our Goethe, our Schiller, our Hegel, our Byron, our Shelley, our Keats, our George Eliot? One could go on, but the point seems evident. Our romantics were opposed and conflicted, prone to compromises and failures of productivity in ways different from, if not more intense than, anything known by their English and European contemporaries. Yet in literature, as in theology, there were such figures. And without some discussion of them, the story of Victorian sentimentalism in America would not be complete. So in the end part of this book, we're going to deal with a real thing, and you can probably guess who that is. They're the big name, you would know. They are all the more heroic, all the more valuable to us, precisely because their achievement was so rare and so threatened. Their romanticism was inevitably characterized and defined by their defiance of sentimentalism and of incipient mass culture. They had to try to move in straitjackets, and motion, not unpredictably, often became contortion, stunted, incomplete. Yet it was motion, and all the more significant, because it took place under conditions and against odds that would increasingly prevail in America and elsewhere. So she's firing a shot. She doesn't like the sentimentalism. She says, we got to praise the ones who are really better than that, and that's what we'll get to in the next chapter. But that's how it was. We see in the evolution of one writer, Harriet Beecher Stowe, from someone who is a genuine moralist into a mere superficial sentimentalist that presaged the coming of the mass society and the superficial clownishness. So I think that was a very, very good segment. And we will have left about maybe 5 sessions. We've got about, we do about 20 a session. These are pretty thick pages, even though it's a paper book. We got to get up to $3.99. So part 3 remains, and we'll talk about Melville. We'll be one of the people. But anyway, thanks for being with me today. As I said, I'm Alex Linder. I've been reading to you from The Feminization of American Culture by Anne Douglas, a book from 1977, and a serious intellectual feminist, believe it or not. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back with you again real soon.